content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anna Dean Silver from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Out in the Garden. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the book by Margaret Roach, A Way to Garden, a hands-on primer for every season. And we will start in the chapter of called Birth, which is March and April. And we start with the title is A Particular Pulmonaria. Leave it to an asthmatic to fall in love with a plant named lungwort. And so I did. Years ago, after the first bit of one was unceremoniously wrenched out of the ground by a nurseryman from his garden after I commented that I liked it. "Have a piece," he said, and threw a plant, soil and all, into the back of my pickup, along with the properly potted up things I'd purchased. "Just cut off all the leaves when you get it home and water it well." I still have a few plants of this unnamed, attractively spotted pulmonaria, and have tried maybe 8 other properly named cultivars, whose foliage ranges from nearly all white, British sterling, to Marjorie Fish, a ghostly silvery green, to plain green, my most beloved, which is P. rubra. Some are narrow-leaved, like Roy Davidson, and the even narrower Bertram Anderson, which are particularly appealing. They fall into different species, and some are hybrids. Look for them by their varietal names. They are among the easiest and earliest of perennials, and are fine informal flowering ground covers for shady spots where they will happily sow themselves around, though not always coming true to type in subsequent generations. So you can share your own pulmonaria crop too. Pulmonaria got its unfortunate common name from 16th and 17th century herbalists who tried it for treating lung ailments. Their rationale, reportedly, was that the spotted leaves looked like a diseased lung. I beg to differ. They are simply beautiful. Most are blue or pink flowered, though Sissinghurst white for one isn't. But sign me up for the red ones, Pulmonaria rubra, of which I have great masses since it comes true from seed. Spring, all pretty in pastels, doesn't have enough red for me, I suppose, which is why I like the wake robin, Trillium erectum, red tulips for cutting, and especially P. rubra. No fancy pants, silver-splashed foliage like its more popular cousins, perhaps, and in hotter summer zones I have read that it is less cooperative. But here it is, the earliest and a gem, just after or even as the hellebores begin and overlap them. P. rubra is the next perennial to open. The snow has barely melted, and there it is, starting to bloom, a foil to every bulb, to early bulbs. It has become a standby for massing in loose sheets in the shade under deciduous shrubs, where I can cover and a little early fun, but not a lot of extra work. It spreads and self-seeds happily, but not aggressively, and is very easy to dig out. More diligent gardeners divide their lungworts every few years to keep the planting vigorous. I have never had to do that with this one. The maintenance regimen includes a hard cutback after flowering. Lungwort will sulk and perhaps go temporarily dormant if dry, and doesn't want to be sodden either. When lungworts are exposed to dry times and muggy weather, a bit of powdery mildew can form, more for me on the silvery and spotted ones than on Pulmonaria rubra. And if so, I shear them again and water well. There are named cultivars of P. rubra, such as Red Start, that is most commonly seen, and even one with variegated white-margined leaves called David Ward. But to me, all the white markings are overkill. The flowers are the point, an extra optimistic flash of red that admittedly burns out after a good long show to pinkish red, the sign of warmer days to come. My only question about P. rubra, why isn't it more widely grown? The next topic is finding room for more natives. I know the garden is full. There's no room at the inn. How do we layer in more native plants then, thereby fostering diversity in all organisms, from pollinators and other beneficial insects to birds and more, when we have established chock-full landscapes? I began as someone who craved every new or rare plant, and my early acquisitions added up to more of a collector's garden than a habitat. My interest in nature and science grew as I spent more time outdoors, though, and also as I have learned more about the intricate evolutionary relationships between native plants and other living things. Can a plant collector's garden become a habitat garden, or do we have to start from scratch? Thankfully, we do not. Even in a suburban-sized yard, I suspect there are hidden opportunities. Imagine a bird's eye view of your property, or better, see an actual image on Google Earth using the 3D view. What would be sacrificed if at least one stretch somewhere along the boundary line moved in a bit, and a mass of low-care native shrubs like winterberry holly, viburnums, and highbush blueberries went there instead, underplanted with native ground cover like sedges or Passisandra procumbens? If there is already hedging at the property line, that's okay. Extend the bed that is now just the hedge inward to make it deeper, even just an extra 6 or 8 feet, and let the hedging become the backdrop for the additions. Walking around my property line, I realized I had many such spots for even deeper low-maintenance beds at the woodland edge, just inside the fence, up to which I had always just mowed. In these spots, large shrubs and small trees like shadbush and redbud could be underplanted with ferns and woodland asters. Perhaps your opportunities are not at the boundaries, but somewhere in the middle of what is now lawn. I've been unmowing some areas into mini meadows as one another native adding tactic. Even a small island could become a native perennial planting, or even better, a mix of shrubs and perennials. There is room. Our next topic is, what is native wear? As a wildflower talk I attended, a lot of the audience questions after the expert finished her slides were one like this: is such and such trillium native here? Or have you ever seen an insert specific fern in the wild locally? We were all curious about the hyper-local version of native plants. Yes, we know the nursery label on a cornflower or lupin or coreopsis may say native, but keen gardeners have figured out that that term is often used quite generically in marketing, perhaps implying U.S. native or maybe regional at best. As I consciously added more natives to my garden, I wanted to learn how to get a little more precise than that. Many states also have a searchable online flora or list of all their recorded plants, even down to county level. Mine is the New York Flora Atlas, new york.plantatlas.usf.edu, for example. Local wildflowers or native plant societies or preserves may have one for your location. A local wildflower field guide is another essential asset. Some online databases use maps to indicate the distribution of a particular genus of plant, including ones from the Biota of North America program, BONAP.org. And though that site can be overwhelming, it was the BONAP maps that got me started wondering, what's really native right here? Other searchable sources I have since discovered about ranges of native plants are, and here are a few, and I'll try and get the ones that are closest to us in North Carolina. There's a database from New England Wildflower Society, which is gobotany.newenglandwild.org. And here's National Wildlife Federation Native Plant Finder is a database searchable by zip code created with University of Delaware and National Forest Service. And that's nwf.org/native plant finder. Another one is a Native Plant Information Network, and this is a database of Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center, and that's wildflower.org/plants. Another one here is Nature Serve Explorer, data on 70,000 plants, animals, and ecosystems of the U.S. and Canada. And that's explorer.natureserve.org. And another one that would be good for us is USDA Plants Database, is Plants of the U.S. and its Territories. And that's plants.usda.gov/java, J-A-V-A. And this other one is just for Canada, so we'll leave that one out. And our next topic is spring water garden regimen. Algae, especially tenacious filamentous string algae or blanket weed can quickly turn a water garden into a battleground. I have been enjoying and managing two in-ground rubber-lined garden pools for more than 25 years, and it's not that hard, despite the sometimes relentless gooey green stuff. And most important, there is no other garden feature that brings more joy or sustains more wildlife than a pool, even a small one. I host many more species of birds, salamanders, and frogs than my waterless neighbors, and have gotten to know a fascinating complement of insects, including dragonflies, stoneflies, caddisflies, fishflies, and dobsonflies. My essential spring maintenance tips are: reduce debris. Organic matter such as leaves on the bottom, which adds nutrients to the water as it decays, and can feed algae growth. I leave a little, which overwintering frogs seem to like hiding in, but remove the bulk of it. Use a net just as the ice on the pool relents, typically in March here, and that's in New York, so it's a lot earlier here. Then turn the plumbing back on. I make another pass with the net and my hands in April. Once the perennial water plants start to sprout, so I can see which parts are dead, and I remove them, but I'm careful not to disturb masses of frog and salamander eggs. I dump the smelly, mucky debris around shrubs. They seem to enjoy the treat, but you could compost it too. Excess nutrients can also enter ponds in the form of fertilizer runoff. Are you feeding flower pots beside a water garden, or is the lawn adjacent and being fertilized? That's not good. Think like the English and add barley straw. Whether actual straw stuffed into a floating sachet-like net bag, or one of the newer extract products sold as pellets, powders, and even liquids, barley straw helps make the water inhospitable for algae. The sachets like about 6 months. Other products are a shorter time. Other non-toxic additives may help. I have been experimenting with other non-toxic and or biological additives, liquids or powders, sometimes formulated in combination with barley extract. They may help settle particles out of the water and or add enzymes and help bacteria, and I think I am favorably impressed. Add periodically according to label directions. Changing the water doesn't work and can actually backfire. Work to improve what you have, consistently keeping a vigilant eye out and adjusting things. Aerating the water with a small spillway or waterfall can help fight some algae species, but not all, though it is much preferable to stagnant water for various other reasons. And who doesn't love the sound of moving water? Filter the biological way. I have pumps and biological filters for both my pools, one in the water of the smaller pool and a larger external unit the size of a wastebasket that's sunk in the ground at the larger one. Inside, both are biological filters, hosting a community of helpful organisms, including bacteria, that build up on the filter medium made of foam or what looks like packing peanuts. The organisms help digest unwanted pond wastes. My units have lasted many years, though every few years the medium or the pumps that power the filters need replacing. UV clarifiers can help too. Some pond filters incorporate the use of ultraviolet light bulbs. When the water passes by these clarifiers, or sterilizers as they are called, algae buildup is prevented. Independent clarifying devices, not housed within the filter, are also available. Critical: shade at least one-third of the water surface. Experts cite that proportions, I shade more, ponds in full sun will be most challenging, and algae will romp. Shading can be more accomplished by siting your pond in part shade or planting shrubs or grasses or other shade-casting objects nearby. Most important and easier. Floating water plants will shade the pond surface, and some also help with overall water health besides blocking light. They are essential. I love the texture of fairy moss or azolla, for instance, and lemna, duckweed, but you might prefer bold water lilies or towering pots of large-leaved elephant ears. Never discard water garden plants into natural waterways, lakes, or ponds. One more shading tactic: non-toxic black water dye. Sold as a powder or liquid, I like the dye because it helps hide the submerged plumbing. Various labels also claim it reduces light entering the water. The dye lasts a few weeks and then needs to be reapplied. If floating, foamy-looking, or stringy algae does occur, reduce it promptly. Use a net or a bamboo cane moved in a circular, swirling motion to entwine the long threads. Net the surface in fall or not. Experts advise netting to prevent debris from entering the pool, but my frogs, birds, and other pond visitors and residents would strongly object and even potentially be injured navigating it. Follow the fall pond care tips in the final section of this book, which we'll probably get to later on, not today, which do not include water changes or scrubbing the liner. They do include keeping a hole open in the ice that might form to prevent gas buildup that would suffocate inhabitants. The open water also welcomes wildlife who want to drink or bathe 365 days a year. And our next topic is name game. Know your weeds. I know a lot of cultivated plants by their proper names, but when it comes to weeds, my knowledge pales. A garden benefiting task for days not conducive to actual outdoor chores is to study weed identification websites and a regionally appropriate field guide and learn to finally address Aliaria petiolata, garlic mustard, or quickweed, with the proper disrespect. I do not think we have a prayer of subduing or at least outsmarting an opponent we are barely acquainted with. Before I started this rainy day home study curriculum, wedged between sessions studying local birds, moths and butterflies, beetles and more, I didn't even remember the botanical Latin name for the ubiquitous dandelion, Taric saccum officinal. Learning names is the gateway to critical tactical knowledge, like figuring out which ones are native and not, for example. Yes, we may call the native impatiens jewelweed and impatiens capensis. We'll try to have its way sowing around a shady garden bed. I may weed it out of a formal spot, but as the clear weed, another native with weed in its common name, I let it sow into a less conspicuous place so insects who use these as host plants, or even the ruby-throated hummingbirds who so enjoy jewelweed flowers, can have a nibble or a drink. Mere common names saying you have an issue with bindweed won't do either. Is it field bindweed, the wild morning glory, or hedge false bindweed? The latter is native where I live, but still an impressive pest with 10-foot vines and matching 10-foot root systems. With a proper ID, we can also learn what a particular weed is related to. No small matter, since many weeds harbor various fungal photogens or viral diseases or attract insects. Queen Anne's lace, or wild carrot, for example, is closely related to the common garden carrot, and if you're growing both plants, transmission from the wild stands to your vegetable is possible. Common chickweed can harbor viral diseases that damage beets, cucumbers, peas, tomatoes, and turnips. And here we are. We've run out of time for today's episode of Out in the Garden. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Anadine Silver, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Out in the Garden is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. And our next podcast will start the next chapter for May and June. And I hope you'll join us for that.